You're listening to a download from theoutdoorstation.co.uk. Number 413.
Hello and welcome back once again to the Outdoor Station. So it appears my last podcast went down well with you, introducing you to the Adventure Sports Podcast and the Tough Girl Podcast. Kurt has emailed me this week telling me his listener figures took a very healthy little blip, so thanks very much and I hope you've enjoyed them. Do please, if you have enjoyed either Sarah's or Kurt's material, or both material hopefully, do drop them a courtesy line or a tweet or something to say hi and that you found them via us. It just keeps the circle of podcasting love going round. Our newsletter list is growing steadily every week, with many people contributing once again with suggestions of campsites to visit and people and businesses to chat to. And these include the ever popular Sean Conway, the Benson family and search and rescue team members. Perhaps that's probably something to look into very soon, as obviously winter is looming. So, on a random basis, I'd like to pull out some names and welcome some people to our newsletter list. These include Ben Farrow, Ian Davenport, Mark Waring, Shiona Kudugu, Ken Knight, Nick Faulkner, Richard Cole. And Richard also sent me some more information exploring the legality of wild camping, which, thank you very much for that, Richard. I am putting it on my desk to go through and try and take further. Who else have we got? Neil Bradshaw, Pete McFarlane, David Hind and John Rigby. Plus a special mention to Jill Dowse, who lives in Penberth in Cornwall, where she tells me Poldark has been filmed during this summer and last summer, much to the benefit of the local economy and tourism in general. She didn't get to meet the stars though. So on to this podcast and this chat with a lady suggested by Colin Wolford and Steve Atwood. They suggested I speak to Nikki Spinks, and I'm really glad I did. As you'll hear, she is a farmer. Nothing unusual about that. She's 49, well, we all get a bit older, and she's recently completed not one, but two circuits of the Bob Graham Round, running 132 miles in less than 48 hours. So if you're needing a little inspiration in your day, here it comes.
Well, I started off as a you know, normal little road runner doing the park runs and 10Ks, and then I went into fell running, and I've just, in the last 10 years, I've gone through the sort of distances, really increasing them as I can. And got up to being able to do the double Bob Graham, which is about 130 miles and two climbs of Everest in May this year.
Wow. Okay. Well, let's just go back to the beginning, if we may, and just see how the progression moved. So you started with sort of 5K, 10K road running. How long ago was this now?
That would have been 2001 when Foot and Mouth was hitting farmers, well, hitting us.
Yeah.
I had started running before Foot and Mouth, and but was restricted to the roads, as was everybody else. And we climbed Ben Nevis in May 2001, just as a walk. The main footpath up it was open, so we climbed that. And that made me realise that, you know, all the effort to get to the top of the hill is really worth it when you see the views on the way down.
So what started you off running then? Was it because of Foot and Mouth and the effect it was having on the farm and you had time on your hands? Why did you start running?
I used to run a lot as a kid, but not competitively in races, but just because I was on a farm, and so I used to be really quite fit, and I was missing that. I was missing that sort of running in the outdoors. I was just really, you know, I was envious of my friends who were going out running, so I started running with a friend to do it.
And did it fit, and does it fit generally within your lifestyle as being a farmer?
Most of the time. In winter, I can get some consistent training in because it's dark on a night and the animals are all inside. But in summer, I get quite frustrated because I can only tend to run once or twice a week but obviously I'm really, really busy on the farm and so actively. And I think that is the same. It just keeps you very fit.
You're 49 now, so I presume then if it's 2001, you must have been mid-30s then when you first started doing the sort of more competitive races.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I can't quite remember what age that would make me, but yeah, mid-30s, 36 or something.
Obviously, you had the Benmont Nevis walk and realised the beauty of getting to the top of mountains. But what's took you from the sort of 5-10K to fell running? Because fell running is a different type of discipline, isn't it?
It is. It was the... While I was training for the Great North Run, I noticed an advert for the Trunts, which is a little four-mile fell race and down near Penistone, about 20 minutes away from me. And I went along and did, it's a series of nine races. So over that summer, I was going down there and doing those off-road races. And I just really enjoyed them, especially compared to the road running I was doing. And I met a lot of friendly people and I just really enjoyed the off-road and the camaraderie between the fell runners as well. So I joined a fell running club and, well, I think I've ditched the road running ever since, really. I've not done another half marathon or 10K since.
So for our female listeners then who'll be listening to this, what's the appeal? What is the appeal of getting cold, wet, dirty and muddy on a fell race?
Well, yes, I think, well, kids love it. I coach the juniors and that's the best bit about it, I think, for them. So I think maybe I'm still in that mindset that it's all just mud and it'll all wash off. The scratches that you get from brambles and rocks will all just heal over. I think for women, I mean, I think it's a sort of bit of a challenge to get off the roads and onto the fells. But once they do it, I think they'll realise that, A, you get a lot better views, it's a lot quieter, you don't have the traffic, the ground's a lot softer under your feet. There's just a lot more going on that's enjoyable.
When did you start sort of doing the sort of more off-road, the fell running?
That would have been 2003, 2004. Okay. I started.
Because I know it's well documented on your website. You obviously had a series of illnesses, cancer-based, from sort of 2006 onwards. That must have come as a big shock at the time.
Yeah, the cancer was definitely a big shock because I was only 39 at that time in 2006. Yeah, so being told you've got cancer and it's probably one of the more aggressive ones because you're a younger woman was certainly a shock to me. And well, put paid to lots of running plans and other plans for that. Well, for the time that I had the cancer, which actually only ended up being not 2 years, but even it was a year and a half that I was going through the treatment and having the reconstruction operations.
And then it's something else continued into 2012, I seem to read.
Yeah, because they can't quite blame it on the tamoxifen, but something caused the my womb lining to thicken up. And so I had loads of tests done on that and they just advised that cells were found that could turn cancerous. And so I'd be advised to have a hysterectomy. So I did go ahead and sort of have that, which... it took a little while getting over because they do cut into all of your stomach muscles. But the after effects of just being basically, I went through the menopause quite a lot earlier and I've no heat control now.
You were obviously very fit when this was diagnosed and you probably maintained a reasonable amount of fitness as best you could during that particular period. Would you say that it was of benefit to your health to have been that fit when you had that unfortunate period of time?
Oh, absolutely, because I could recover from the operations a lot quicker than other people on the ward. I was sort of up and about sort of the day after. And I think the surgeons also said it was sort of nice working on me. I don't know, because obviously they could get to the bits they needed to get to very easily. And, I mean, the next day when after the hysterectomy, I was up making getting coffee for the other patients, and the surgeon was absolutely amazed that I was actually able to walk. And I think also because you've been through the training, the mentality of having to push yourself through training and that barrier of pain, yeah, you recover from the operations because you'll actually, even though it hurts a little bit, you'll make yourself get up and get out of bed. The pain's not, you know, it's bearable, so you work through it.
Yeah, I was going to come on to the mental approach you've got to life and whether you had that strength of approach Did that grow from when you first started doing the running, sort of 2001, or was it something, do you think it's inherent, you've always had that positive attitude to life?
I think you've always had it. It's like you don't really know how you're going to react to being told you've got cancer or any situation in life until it actually happens to you. You can imagine that you'd like to think, oh, yes, I'll be really strong and I'll be really organised, but you never really know. You know, you could be in a car accident and you'll think, oh, would I be really good or would I actually just fall to pieces? But you won't know till it happens. But so I've always been a strong person and a positive person through the other sort of things in my life. But, I think I needed to sort of draw on all that strength to get through the cancer, which I did.
Well, certainly I know from personal experience, living a rural life and no offence, but coming from Yorkshire, you'll have a much more of a let's get on with it sort of attitude, I would think.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, out in the farm as well, it's not a matter of, you know, we're tired or it's dark or it's raining. We can't just leave the animals and go inside. You've just got to get on with it. And I think that's the thing why I'm good at ultra races, because I'm sort of fairly good at just thinking, well, this might be a long day.
One way to look at it.
Yeah.
What I'd like to explore with you, really, if I may, is I can see the advancement and change of route going to fell running. But to me, as a runner in the past, what's the step? What is is it a physical or a mental step where you go from doing that to saying, right, I'm going to start doing the Bob Graham round. I'm going to start doing 24-hour type events.
I think that, I mean, a lot of people will be going through the general progression. They might go down and start with a park run, and then once they've done a few, they'll enter a 10K because they just want to sort of push themselves a little bit further. It's just that I haven't stopped yet trying to push myself. My body's not said, oh, I'm not doing that, get lost. So I just keep adding. And it was the same with the Bob Graham. I'd done a few 20-mile races that took maybe 4 or 5 hours. And so I thought somebody was doing the Bob Graham in the club in Penistone. And I just wondered whether I could do that. So, and I think once I get that little idea, oh, I wonder if I could do that in my head, I just work towards doing it. I just find a way of, oh, well, if I up my training now and I went to the lakes and I recorded it like this and I get the support, and I just don't see a reason why there isn't a, why I couldn't do it.
Well, certainly, the notes I've made here, and from what I can find, you've got a record in 2011 for doing 64 peaks in 24 hours, or 23 hours and 15 minutes on the Bob Graham round. Now, I understand the round itself is 42, so did you do sort of a round and a half on that particular time?
There's quite a few rules set down for the Lake District 24-hour record, because you have to, it is an extended Bob Graham in a way, but you have to do the route that the person before you, the current record holder, does. So I had to do all the peaks that Anne had done. I could do them in a different order, but she'd obviously done them in the most logical way of doing them. So you set out on the Bob Graham sort of round, but you dodge off and add all the other hills in that you can, well, you can get to in the allotted time.
So just to explain to our listeners, if they've not heard what the Bob Graham Round is, it's a series of fells in the Lake District. The established route, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but the notes I've made, that the established route is 66 miles, which takes in 42 summits within 24 hours with 27,000 feet of ascent. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And you have to start and finish at the Moot Hall with the Bob Graham Round.
Okay.
The Moot Hall in Keswick. So there is sort of, you can't just start in, say, Wasdale and go around like that. Although, I think that's probably true.
So what was the first, I mean, how did you feel? What was the first 24-hour event or race that you did? And how did you feel in yourself while you were running the event and afterwards?
Well, the first 24-hour one I did was the Bob Graham. I went up in April 2005 and sort of walked and ran round the legs, so I knew where I was going. But it was an organized attempt, so there was sort of supporters. I had my own supporters, and I think I had a what we call a bad spell about 4 o'clock in the morning, which is often a bad time for people because your body's just realizing it's missed out on a night's sleep. So I would have set off at 6:30 on Friday night, and it would now be 4 o'clock in the morning on Saturday morning. So I felt really sick for about two hours. And a friend had said to me, you know, if you have one of these bad spells where you just feel absolutely terrible and you want to give up, just keep walking, just keep going. And, you know, they just pass away, and you suddenly, you know, as it gets more daylight, your body just thinks, oh, okay, then that was odd, but we'll just carry on running. And that's what happened to me. And I came through the bad spell and carried on going. So I finished that Bob Graham in 23 and a half hours and just felt really elated. And then about half an hour later, I was like, I need to sleep.
I'm not surprised. And yeah. You said you had support. So how does it work then? Do you have somebody sort of join you at certain times, or do people just join you for as long as they can manage, or are you completely on your own?
No, you're rarely on your own. There's five legs, and so you try and get two of your friends to run along with you and carry some food and any spare clothes you might want. So they will provide all the food and the drink that you need. You can carry, you tend to carry a little bit yourself in case something happens to your supporters, but generally they provide that. And they'll carry the maps, and hopefully if you're going through a bad spell and you're not really concentrating on the route, then they'll pick that up for you and navigate for you.
Right, so it's not sort of completely self-contained then? You don't have to carry all your own food and all your own equipment just in case? You have a sort of a basic amount, but your support team, that's what they're there for, as well as moral support.
Yeah, and people, you know, I've supported lots of rounds and people support me. It's a give and take with that. You know, you can't just turn up and expect loads of people to just support you and then you tick it off your list and never seen again. It is really a... You give support and then you get support back, really.
I noticed they've got a website. The actual round has got its own website, and I get the feeling it's very much like a real specialist club. You know, you've gone to the elite status once you start joining this club. Is that right?
Yeah, it is. It's a really special club, and they have a dinner every 2 years where they give out certificates to the people that have completed in that period. It is. It's like that.
So I know we'll come on to the double round, which is even more impressive, shortly. But after that, you then started into ultra running. Now, is ultra running over 26 miles or is it over 50 miles? Is there a set definition for what that consists of?
I don't think there is a set definition. Maybe Wikipedia would say, but I think over 26 miles is probably what people call. I mean, I know a 30-mile race is an ultra race, so yeah, it's probably over 26 miles, and then up to, well, as far as you can go.
When you sign up for the Outdoor Station newsletter, you have the option to give us feedback on our shows. You also have the opportunity to suggest people of interest you would like to hear more about. You can also suggest UK campsites which you feel may be unique, and cottage manufacturers who would appreciate a little exposure to our wider audience.
The Outdoor Station, sharing the passion, appreciation and understanding for the outdoors world.
So I know, as you've admitted, you know, you want to push yourself and go forward into the next challenge, and the ultra race being the next one. So, and I noticed you did the Mont Blanc. Was that the first of its category of that type? You did?
Oh, that I've done? No, I did Grand Raid Reunion in 2009 with some friends. And then I did the Grand Raid Pyrenees twice. And then I went and did the Mont Blanc in 2014. But I didn't have a brilliant race. I suffered really badly in the last 30 miles. So I really wanted to go back this year and do it sort of what I call properly.
I've read your diary and your report on that race, and again, I appreciate your honesty, and I think it's going to be really useful for people that look you up and research the data, because there's a lot there of information there that makes an awful lot of good sense. But what does it feel like to do an ultra? I mean, obviously you're fit and you're strong, and anybody that does a Bob Graham could go on to an ultra, I'm sure. But mentally, there must be lots of different peaks and troughs that you go through. I would estimate or guess that initially it starts off, everything's different and interesting. The language is different. The people are different. The environment's different. But once you start stretching out and get to be running on your own, it must be quite a few hurdles that you mentally have to go through.
I think that's like 50% of running an ultra is sort of your mental strength. Because you go through a lot of very, you know, you're on your own or you're in your own little world for a very long time and it can't go, you know, completely right all that time. You've got to start feeling a bit sick or a bit tired and people start passing you. Or, I mean, like in the Mont Blanc this year, it was really quite hot and I don't like the heat. So you have to sort of deal with that in your head and then actually go through with it. So if you say, right, I'm going to slow down because I don't like the heat, or I'm going to drink more, I'm going to eat more, you've actually, it's not that easy to make yourself eat and drink more on these ultras. Your body actually wants to sort of not eat and drink at all, but you know in your head that you can't let it do that.
And is there a battle continually between your head and your body trying to find the compromise to enable you to maintain that energy?
Yes, I think that is. It's a battle, the argument that the self with you having in your head, right, I'm going to eat this, well, and you know, don't feel like it, but you've got to do it. And so I think a lot of the time people say to me, what do you think about? And it's actually, it's what I'm going to eat next or what I'm going to force myself to eat next. And every now and again, like if you're out for, I was out for 32 and a half hours on the UTMB. So for quite a lot of the time I'm actually running along quite happily and the food's going down quite easily, and you're actually enjoying it. The views are stunning. You found some nice people to talk to, pass the time. So it's just the bad bits do seem to, they seem bad when you're going through them, and then afterwards you forget about them.
Yeah. On a run like that particular ultra, well, any of them really, are you running all the time, or is it, you know, you do a bit of scrambling to get at some of the steep paths and whatever and take it steady going down, or is it like a mixture of walk-run?
Oh, definitely walk-run. And that was the first lesson I learned for the Bob Graham, is that, you know, you walk all the ups and even the slight gradients, it's a good idea just to start walking them. And then you run the downs and the flats. Because if you start running, trying to run all the uphills to start with, you'll end up at the end of the round for the last leg, not being able to run any of it. And you end up walking up, down and on the flat. And then you lose all the time that you ever gained in the first section running all the ups. So that sort of pace and that strength to sort of be strict with yourself so that you do walk the ups even when you feel strong enough to run them is key to actually completing the ultras.
And the kind of pace that you do, and the kind of pace that people do, rather, you know, collectively when you're doing this type of thing, is it like a sort of a quick jog as opposed to a more hearty cross-country run?
Oh yeah, definitely it's a jog, so that you're never really out of breath. Maybe you can be out of breath climbing, but generally the idea is to get into a state where you can keep going for a long time. And the only way to do that is to sort of, you know, be at a comfortable pace so that you're not pushing your body too hard.
And talking your body, what does your body actually go through? Again, you detail it quite well on the website, but in your own words, you know, what sort of deficit, what sort of changes take place in your body over sort of 30, 50 miles?
I think you've got to manage yourself as you're going along, so that if you've got to keep your energy levels up, that's the first thing. But then other little things, like things that are rubbing you, like around, you know, your rucksacks and then blisters, obviously. If you're getting a little blister, you've got to look at them. Because I mean, this time I actually Vaseline my feet for about 6 months. I was putting pseudo cream on them every night because I always tend to, with the hard skin that I build up farming, wearing Wellingtons, about 6 weeks after I've done one of these ultras, all the skin comes off of my feet, and it's the friction between the hard skin and the soft skin. So it's all things like that, is just like self-body management, really. And after I've done the race, I mean, obviously for a couple of weeks you feel you're quite hungry and you'd feel tired. And then I'm constantly sort of trying to figure out when I've actually properly recovered from doing one of these things, because it does take 6 to 8 weeks before you could probably say, you know, you totally recovered and you were back, you're back at the fitness and the strength levels that you were before you actually did it.
But of course, you're back to work the following day, if not the same day, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm often back to work. Yeah, the day after the double Bob Graham, I was driving home and having all these phone calls and thinking, wow, the world's gone mad and I need to get back and do some farming.
So let's come on to the double Bob Graham then. This is an incredible achievement. 2016, May this year, you did, well, as you say, 120 odd miles in 48 hours. Apart from being a bit addicted to the Bob Graham round, how did you feel completing that?
I always thought it was going to be interesting because I really never knew that I could do it. A lot of the challenges I go and do now, I know I can do. I've either done the distance before or the time on my legs, you know, awake before, but I'd never been awake more than 36 hours and I'd never done more than 100 miles. So everything was new to me, plus the mentality of doing a sort of lap and a half and then coming back and doing the same hills twice, things like that. So, yeah, it felt incredible to actually finish and touch the Moot Hall and think, wow, I've actually done it. It was a bit like a dream.
Well, certainly I saw there's a little video clip I've come across of you finishing and, as you say, touching the door there. And it's like, okay, right, that's that done. Better get back to work now.
I turned around and I couldn't believe how many people were there because it's not, you know, usually there's like a handful or your supporters, which adds up to about 20 to 25 people. And the place was absolutely packed.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I suppose it's difficult, isn't it? You set yourself a challenge like that and there's a few hundred people waiting for you and you think, oh, well, I'll just pack it in. I won't do it now. And they're all standing there. You can't let them down, can you?
Oh, no. No, I don't think I'd stop anyway, but I would hate to let everybody down.
Well, congratulations on that. It's an awesome achievement, and there's lots of articles online written about you on that. And I can see now why the person concerned suggested I should talk to you, because it really is very, very impressive at 49 to do something like that. But it also shows you that, obviously, people of, I'm in the same age range, people of our age are able to do all these things. There's no reason to doubt yourself just because you're getting a bit older.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think experience as well. We've got a lot more experience than a little whippet of 20. If you fancy doing something, then just work slowly towards it and you can do it.
Yeah. Obviously, with the farming is a full-time occupation. How do you, you know, what's your balance? What's your time scale? Do you set yourself like, I'm training in the morning, then in the afternoon, or do you just do it when you've got, you know, a half an hour time free?
Often I'll have I try and enter a race at a weekend. So I'll race either probably nearly every weekend or every other weekend. Or at least maybe twice a month, something like that. And in between that, in winter, it's always Mondays and Thursdays and then the weekend. And then I coach juniors on Tuesday. So it's fairly well set in that's what I'm doing. And I can do that because I can get away from the farm. But In summer, it's more like I'll race at the weekend and then I'll just see how the week goes. Sometimes I'll only run sort of once and it'll be quite a slow jog because I'm so tired from working. So, yeah, it's a bit hit and miss as it goes on. But I think it's not a bad thing because I come out of winter usually quite strong and fit. And then with how much racing I do and the long stuff I do, I think it works quite well that I can actually recover during the summer.
And if you said I'm going for a training run, what actually does that consist of?
Well, I'm heading out tonight and I'll do 10. It's only 10 miles. It takes about 2 hours. It's off road and there's two climbs of about 500 metres in there. So there's about 1,000 metres climb. I try and get long runs with climbing. They're really important to me. And then the training I do on Mondays is more of speed and hill, like specific short stuff. And I think those are the two key training sessions that I like to do. And then I also, when I can, go to the Lake District or Wales and do like a full day of sort of recceing, like run walking up a lot of hills.
So looking back over the last, almost 20 years then, what would you describe, two things would you describe as being your highest point and your lowest point in all the events that you've done?
That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, the lowest point has got to be the day that they said there's a 3 in 5 chance you've got cancer. That was like, I'd gone on my own to get the test results because I didn't think anything of having this lump in my breast. To actually walk out with that. And then I was trying, my husband said, oh, ring me when you get out. And I couldn't even speak on it because as soon as I started trying to, as soon as it was actually sinking into me what was actually going to happen to me or could be happening to me, then, I was in tears. And I spent a lot of time in tears, and that's not like me either because I'm not I don't cry a lot. So for that first week, it was like everything was making me cry. And then I think once they'd set the date for the operation and I'd had the operation, and then actually 2 weeks later after the operation, I was actually feeling a lot more positive. It was nice to get rid of the cancer. It was nice to have it cut out of my body. And that's how I saw it. I just saw it as like, right, that's sort of hopefully gone and let's get on a little bit with trying to work towards some sort of normality. And then the high, well, I don't know. I've had so many. As soon as you said it, I thought, well, the first time there was a race when I first started called Marsden to Edale, which I organise now. And I did it 1 year and I did sort of 4.5 hours. And then I started training properly, doing speed training and long hill training. And 2 years later, I actually won the race and I did it in under 4 hours. So I knocked half an hour off. And I remember running down the last road section and everyone was like, well done, first woman. And I got across the line and I was absolutely bouncing on the spot. My excitement was so great at actually having won a race that, I never used to win races back then. It was just like the first race I'd ever won. Plus it was the Marsden to Edale race, which was my iconic race. So that was one highlight. But I mean, I've just had so many. Every time I finish, one of these rounds, I never looked too happy because as soon as I finished, I just feel completely drained because I've been concentrating for however many hours and, eating and all that. And I just want sleep. But so I never looked that happy. But the feeling of contentment this year, having done the double Bob Graham, has been fantastic. Every time I just look back at the pictures, they're on my screensaver, the pictures of the double Bob Graham, and I come into the office and just, yes, I remember that, So, yeah, I'm on a high most of the time.
Oh, brilliant. Brilliant. Yeah. Imprinted in your mind. So, and over the same period of time then, the 20 years, what specific thing have you learned about yourself that's come as a surprise?
I think my strength, actually. I knew I was sort of fairly strong. My childhood was a bit sort of hit and miss. So I had a stepmother I fell out with a lot, and I left home at 17. So I had to sort of set up myself and sort myself out from a very young age. But yeah, I think I never realised how well I would cope with having the cancer and how positive I can be. And it's really good to know that.
Very, very briefly, then we're just sort of coming to an end now. Definitely we have listeners who are all gear freaks, equipment freaks, and interested in what people use for different things. So most of your events, I take it, are fairly basic running equipment, obviously, trainers, wind shirts and et cetera, and rucksack and whatever. But I'd love to know what equipment you use and, any particular equipment that you said that's really good and something that hasn't particularly worked out very well. What's been the best bit of kit and the worst bit of kit, in other words?
Well, with kit, I think with running on the fells, the first thing you need is a pair of decent fell shoes. And I've actually, although Innovate, I'm an Innovate ambassador now, I've been buying Innovate since they first started up in 2006 or 7 or whatever. I started off with them then, and I can't fault the shoes. The Mud Claws are the shoes for me. I mean, there are other models that they make that other fell runners use, but the Mud Claws for me are the ones that I've done all my rounds in. So that's the shoes. And yeah, for kit and the rest of it, I don't tend to be a gear freak. I just sort of stick with what I know. What wouldn't work for me? I don't think bum bags work for me because I don't like the strap across my stomach, because I think also it's unfortunate that that actually I've got a sort of fairly sensitive stomach as it is. I'm not a, which is unfortunate because that's one thing you could do with it with, when you're ultra running, is a nice solid stomach that'll eat anything anywhere. But no, so I think bum bags don't work for me personally. I've always used a tiny little rucksack, and now these race vests are coming out. They're absolutely wonderful for me because they're just like a little mini, you know, they're light and small and they fit on your back and they carry about, I don't know, 5 kilos worth of stuff, just about enough that you need to get, you know, through your compulsory kit that you need to carry in a fell race. So I think, yeah. Is that fine?
I saw a picture of you wearing one of the race coats and also carrying some walking poles as well, which looked like lightweight poles. So I was just curious to know if, you know, if that system really works for the fell running community.
I think poles is I've started using poles since about 2010, but only on the ultra races. I've never used them on my rounds. I think that, and I think for the ultra races like the UTMB, they're invaluable. You can't, I mean, they all use them out in Europe, and it's just taking us a bit longer to sort of cotton onto the fact. I mean, walkers always use them. So they've been around in England, but they're the fairly solid ones. But these lightweight things that you can just fold up, I use the Mountain King ones, and yeah, they just sort of, they're held together by a bit of cord, so you can sort of untouch them and carry them. They're about a foot long, so five or six sections. But actually, once you get them out, you just tend to have them out now. I was looking back at my UTMB photos, and I've got poles in every one because I just wouldn't be without them now on a long race.
Mm. And is that the carbon ones or the alloy ones you got from Mountain King?
Carbon, I think, yeah.
They're superb, aren't they?
Yeah.
Well, Nikki, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you, and thank you for taking time out of your busy day. I'm sure people will be thrilled to read all this and no doubt follow it with all the various information and contacts which I'll place on the website. But I do have one final question for you, and we've covered a lot in this, but it's a completely open question, and that is, of all the things I could have asked you, what should I have asked you?
You ask some difficult questions. What should you have asked me? Oh, probably what's next.
No, it's too easy, but go on.
Yeah. Well, I don't usually like to say until I'm sort of know that I'm going to do it. I didn't tell anyone about the double Bob Graham until about 2 days before. But I'm definitely hopefully doing the Joss Naylor next year, which is the challenge that you've got to be 50 to do. So that's one good thing about being 50. I'm sure there are lots of others, but I will be doing the Joss Naylor. And I don't know about any other questions. No, sorry.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much indeed for your time.
Thank you. Thank you, Bob.
I'm sure you'll agree, what a lovely lady and inspiring person. All of the links, of course, photos, charity details, etc., etc., will be on the Outdoor Station website, of course. And I'm sure any donation you wish to make will be greatly appreciated. So that's about it from me this week. If you haven't done so already, do join in the fun and add your name to the newsletter page and make various suggestions if you can think of people or places worth talking about. I'm continually trying to keep the variation coming, speaking to a whole variety of different people. So until next time, I'll leave you with this appropriate comment from Finnis Mitchell. We don't stop hiking because we grow old. We grow old because we stop hiking. Bye for now.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To hear or see more from our extensive free library, please visit theoutdoorstation.co.uk.